WBUR, Boston WRNI, Providence. This is On Point. I'm Jack Beatty, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. As the battle between George W. Bush and congressional Democrats over judicial nominees heats up, the U.S. Supreme Court is on the verge of being transformed. At stake is no longer simply the questions of abortion rights and other issues that have traditionally defined the liberal and conservative positions. At stake is the scope of federal power and, critics fear, democratic governance itself. We begin tonight with the latest developments in the priest sex abuse scandal. In Boston today, Cardinal Bernard Law was ordered to answer questions from the attorney for 86 people who alleged that Law was negligent in supervising defrocked priest John Gagan. WBUR's Monica Brady Meyeroff has been following the church scandal. Moments ago, I asked her what the cardinal said under oath.
Well, he was asked a range of questions, some as mundane as where were you born and where did you go to school, and then many were much more specific, though, that moved on to the Gagan case. This is all centered on the case of defrocked priest John Gagan, and he was asked when did he meet him and when did he first learn that there were allegations against Gagan involving homosexual abuse of young boys. And what he was told was that the lawyers presented him with a letter and said, did you see this letter? This letter came from a parishioner who claims that seven of her nephews were molested by John Gagan, and she was writing to the cardinal outraged that she discovered he was still practicing as a priest in a parish. And Cardinal Law said that he had not does not recall reading the letter, but on the outside of the envelope was handwriting that he claimed is his handwriting, and it said, urgent, Bishop Daly, urgent, please follow through. That's referring to Bishop Daly, who is now head of the Brooklyn Diocese and who was his right-hand man at the time, and basically showing that Law was relying on his subordinates to take care of accusations of sexual abuse of minors. He said on several occasions he had asked other people to follow it up, and that although the Archdiocese had no written policy on how to handle allegations of sexual abuse, it was an unwritten policy that he said everyone knew about and was expected to follow, and that was that the person should go for treatment, and once medical advice was received that that person was competent to remain in a parish, they should be assigned to a parish.
So was he, in effect, saying, I wasn't really responsible for these decisions. They were made by people below me. And was he passing the buck here to these other people?
I felt from reading the deposition, because it was close to the public, that, yes, he was passing the buck at times. For instance, here's a quote from the deposition. When asked about Law relying on medical advice, his answer is, quote, what I'm aware of is my expectation, and that expectation was understood by those who assisted me. It was that no one could be assigned unless there were an attestation from someone professionally competent to give it that that person could be safely put. So in that answer, again, he says, my expectation was understood by those involved. So he really was, he said he was relying on others to make these decisions.
Was there incredulity on the part of the questioners? Was there hostility? How did they react to his responses?
Following the deposition, the attorney for the alleged victim said he was incredulous that Law had no recollection of, say, this letter from a parishioner claiming mm-hmm. that a priest of his, someone under his archdiocese, had abused these boys. He really didn't believe that Law could not remember this letter and was skeptical that he just passed everything off to subordinates to handle.
What was the feeling in the room? Here's the Cardinal Archbishop of Boston to someone like me, born here, the idea of Richard Cardinal Cushing at a deposition, impossible to believe.
From reading the transcript, he was very cooperative. He answered the questions straightforward. His lawyer made a blanket objection to the questions, all the questions, on First Amendment grounds, saying that basically the lawyers have no business asking about church inner workings. But that said, Law went on to just answer everything forthrightly and completely and seemed very at ease from reading the transcript. He even made a joke at one point and another time exclaimed, oh, heavens, you know, I don't recall when he was assigned to whatever. So he seemed at ease from reading the transcript.
Well, what happens next? I mean, he's got several more days?
Yeah, he will be back with lawyers on Friday being deposed. This time it will not take place in the closed courtroom as it did today. It'll take place at his residence, at his home. And also on Monday he'll be deposed because the lawyers for the alleged victims say they have about 9 more hours, they think, of questions for Cardinal Law.
And deposed, this is in relation to a civil suit against the Archdiocese on behalf of the victims of John
Gagan.
That's
right. Mm-hmm.
And the deposition is essentially allowing the plaintiff to look at the evidence to try to elicit the grounds of this suit.
That's right. And this all came about because the church backed out of the settlement in these mm-hmm. civil suits on Friday. I mean, this involves 86 plaintiffs, and they had all agreed to this $15 to $30 million settlement, so this case would never go to court. If you recall, several months ago, there kept being news that Cardinal Law was about to be deposed in this case. He was about to be deposed about four times until they settled the lawsuits. Mm-hmm. So it sounded like that was shelved for now, at least concerning John Gagan, mm-hmm. until the church backed out of the settlement. Then the lawyer for the alleged victims went to court and expedited the process. On Monday, she said, let's get it done. We don't want him to go to Rome on any official business or slip out of town, perhaps, and scheduled it for Wednesday. And today, he finally sat down and answered questions under oath. And this is the first time he's done this under oath since he's been in charge of this archdiocese and since the news of the sex abuse scandal broke back in January.
Now, his reaction on the issue of the Gagan case, he said that they backed out of the settlement because the finance committee of the archdiocese basically told him he couldn't do it, and he said, "I'm sorry, that's not in my hands." That's a similar sort of modus operandi on the cardinal's part.
That's a very good point. You know, he did use the same excuse, basically, as to what happened in this situation, saying that it is out of his hands. Now, a judge is reviewing the settlement to see whether or not a verbal agreement on the settlement is enough to hold the church to it. Mm. So in the next couple weeks, we're going to see a hearing on that, because it's possible the church could be forced to go back to that settlement.
Were there any demonstrators outside the courtroom?
There were a couple people on the street in front of the courtroom saying Law should go to jail, should be held criminally responsible for his actions in this case. No criminal charges have been filed against him or any other church officials. But mostly it was a media circus trying to get a shot of the cardinal going into a criminal building, which, as you said, is a sight unseen before today in a Catholic town such as Boston.
And rare in the United States. As I understand it, it's only happened once, and that was in Los Angeles in connection with a similar case.
That's right. Very rare. But now it might be becoming a regular occurrence, at least with Law, as we'll have him back with lawyers on Friday and Monday. And then on June 5th, he's scheduled to be deposed about another case, Father Paul Shanley, other civil suits involving Father Shanley.
Monica Brady Meyerhoff is a reporter for WBUR. At least three members of the current U.S. Supreme Court appear to be prepared to call into question the constitutionality of much of the social legislation of the last 60 years. President George W. Bush's possible nominees to the courts, to the court, critics fear, could join with these justices to effect nothing less than a constitutional revolution. On Point listeners, should Congress have the power to impose environmental laws, regulate water and air quality, legislate on cloning and homeland security? Or should these powers be delegated to state governments? What does we the people mean to you? We the people of one nation or we the people of individual states? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. With me in the studio today is On Point analyst Julia Kayyem, head of the Domestic Preparedness Program at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government.
Good evening, Jack.
Nice to have you with us again. Our guest in the studio is Randy Barnett, Austin B. Fletcher Professor of Law at the Boston University School of Law and currently a visiting professor at Harvard Law School. Welcome.
Good to be here.
He's the author of The Structure of Liberty, Justice and the Rule of Law. And joining us from Stanford, California, is Bruce Ackerman, Sterling Professor of Law and Political Science at Yale Law School. Welcome, Bruce.
Hi, how are you?
Well, fine. I'm glad to have you. Randy, help me out on this. In the story that I look at things historically, and here's my sort of historical prologue. In the years following the Civil War, the Supreme Court consistently voted down legislation by Congress that would regulate the economy and society of the United States on various grounds. But one of them was these estate powers. Others had to do with something called substantive due process that we don't want to get into. And then along came the New Deal. And Franklin Roosevelt passed all these laws, the Congress passed all these laws that would affect the economy of the country much beyond the mere purview of the literal words of interstate commerce, and that would affect all sorts of things in society. And he was faced with that same Supreme Court saying, as it had all through the 19th century, no, this is unconstitutional. He packed the court, or he threatened to pack the court, and he got the constitutional revolution of 1937. The Supreme Court says, you're right, this is constitutional, and social legislation, Congress has the power to do this. Now, are you saying, and do proponents of the new federalism say, that the constitutional revolution of 1937 was wrong?
Well, first of all, you should probably know, but it doesn't really affect the subject of today's program, that most thoughtful, knowledgeable legal historians no longer think that there was a revolution that happened in 37 itself as a result of the court packing scheme. Rather, they think there were doctrinal developments that began much earlier as a result of Hoover appointees and culminated actually in a complete change in the way the Constitution was interpreted actually somewhat later. So it was about a 10-year process of change rather than this moment.
Right.
Dramatic
okay.
confrontation. But it doesn't
taken.
Really change the basic mm-hmm. thesis of your program, which is that prior to this process happening, the Constitution was interpreted to grant Congress only the limited enumerated powers that are listed in Article 1. And after this transformation happened, Congress was given a much, much more broad scope of powers. In fact, practically speaking, unlimited powers. Until the Rehnquist Court in the 90s, there had not been a single law that had been struck down by the Supreme Court as exceeding Congress's power. And in fact, in the Lopez case where this happened, when the Solicitor General was asked by Justice Scalia for an example of any law that he thought was beyond the power of Congress to enact, he couldn't come up with one, nor could the dissenters in that case. So for about 60 years, and only that 60 years, Congress was granted by the Supreme Court unlimited powers. And since the 90s, the court has moved to restore the idea that we have a government, a national government of limited powers, and those powers are listed in the Constitution.
And in effect, is the logic of this to sort of go back to 1936?
Well,
metaphorically speaking,
actually, probably the best starting point for this discussion would be at the actually first sentence of the Constitution after the preamble, mm-hmm. which says, "All legislative powers herein granted shall be vested in the Congress of the United States." And the herein granted means it has to be listed someplace else in the Constitution, or Congress doesn't have that power. In fact, the judicial power isn't described that way, nor is the executive power. Only the legislative power is described in terms of powers herein granted. So the idea here is to restore some measure of limits. Now, as for what the Rehnquist Court is up to, there appears to be – there's at least – other than Justice Thomas, there appears to be no inclination to go back to a previous time. Rather, though that could be in their minds, who knows what's in people's minds. Mm-hmm. But what they've actually done is in some sense kind of formulated a doctrine which would grandfather in everything that currently exists and not to challenge anything that currently exists.
I see.
But to figure out limits beyond which Congress may not go now.
Thus far and no farther.
Right. And they've had some, you know, it is a challenge because that is not rooted in the Constitution itself. Mm-hmm. The Constitution mm-hmm. actually limits powers of Congress much, much beyond that.
Mm-hmm.
But that seems to be what their project is. It's an interim project.
Is the new federalism in our future, do you think, Judith?
Likely, I think. And I think, this debate, has had two important aspects. The first is, I hope, that both by conservatives and liberals, that the term or accusation of being a judicial activist is now no longer on the table. Liberals can be judicial activists. Conservatives can be judicial activists. And we can learn to, at least in the political process, debate this on the merits. Secondly, I think that the challenge to the Congress and what they've been doing has probably made Congress a little bit more careful about their legislation and how they write it. I think that's been important for a number of reasons. Congress should be a little bit more careful about how they draft legislation. I think it's important for a historical record. It's important when courts interpret opinions that Congress be clear about what they're saying. So there's been, I think, these two benefits. But I wonder... When we talked about this before we went on air, and I'll finish that later, Jack.
Please, wonder later with us.
Wonder out loud.
just in a moment. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We'll be right back.
From Boston University,
this is Jack Beatty. This is On Point. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Our subject is the new federalism. Do you think Congress should be able to legislate about our economic and social affairs, or do those matters belong with state governments? Call us at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Judith Kayyem, before the break, you were wondering.
I was wondering out loud, it's an ironic thing to be having this discussion now at a time, at least since September 11th, when we are all talking about the imperial presidency. There is, I don't want to say Congress is irrelevant, but certainly in a lot of the powers the government is asserting since September 11th, most of them are not legislative. And we can list off a number of things coming out of the White House that are being done just basically under a president's authority. In that instance, it seems like the tables will probably be switched, at least for these conservative justices, that they will give a lot of deference to the president to do unilateral things in sort of against state rights, or however you want to describe it. And I think liberals will probably be looking to the courts for some sort of check on this power or assertion of power since September 11th.
Well, we'll see. Bruce Ackerman, we want to bring you in here. Bruce, in an article in the current Atlantic Monthly, Simon Lazarus, a Washington lawyer and a former member of Jimmy Carter's White House legal staff, writes, the nation may have arrived at a new constitutional watershed. And he pictures basically a situation where powers that we now think Congress has will be exercised by the states that will return in some measure to the world before the New Deal. What do you think?
Well, as Randy was suggesting, this is very much a work in progress of five members of the Supreme Court. And it's really very hard to know. The crucial issues here are, first, the fundamental constitutional failure of regulating the appointment process. In the last 24 years, we've had seven judicial appointments, five by Republican mm-hmm. presidents and two by Democratic presidents. But in the last 24 years, there have been 12 years of Democratic presidents and 12 years of Republican presidents. There has been this escalating effort by presidents. It happens in this case, the Republicans, but we can see this also, to appoint younger and younger people mm-hmm. to the Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. And then we have this absurd system where 51 senators can confirm a nomination. Now, this compares with the constitutional unfavorably with the constitutions designed after the Second World War. For example, the German system, which is, I think, much the best, the two-thirds mm-hmm. majorities are necessary.
To appoint someone to the Supreme Court.
That's right, to the Constitutional Court.
Why does that matter? Why is
that
important?
Well, that means that there aren't going to be extremists appointed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You see?
Yeah.
And also, there is a fixed term, 12, 15 years, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So what we're seeing now, unfortunately, is the danger of strategic resignation.
Strategic resignation,
that's
meaning?
That's right. The justices wait until one of their guys is in the White House,
mm-hmm.
and then they resign.
Mm-hmm.
Why
mm-hmm.
is it that there were only two resignations between 1992 and 2000?
Mm-hmm.
This is a very bad system, hyper-political. And, of course, now we have it. Now we have something which is much worse. The Supreme Court, 5-4, the same five. We shouldn't call it the Supreme Court. There are just five people doing this, appointing a president.
Mm-hmm. Right,
and
right.
then the mm-hmm. president then resigning mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. and then having their delegate in an yeah. opinion that almost nobody thinks is a credible opinion.
Right, but let's just get back to this yes. business about the new federalism.
It's tea leaf time, you know. We can read these opinions narrowly or broadly, and the great oak tree will develop if George W. Bush can, in one of a number of ways, get a couple of radicals onto the Supreme Court. The ways are several. One way is appoint Orrin Hatch or someone who will get on in, by senatorial courtesy. Or another person. Another way is a stealth candidate.
Mm-hmm.
Or another way, of course, is which is a Thomas variant in which he appoints a Latino reactionary.
Right. But of course, some people would say that the stealth issue here is this whole question of shall Congress have the power to write these laws or shall these go back to the state? In other words, the conservative, the constitutional revolution. But this is masked because we keep talking about strict construction.
Of course, we keep
talking about abortion rights and civil rights. Those things are important.
Right.
But this other agenda is kind of hidden. And this seems of momentous weight. Am I right about this?
Quite right. And you see, I mean, what my fundamental concern is to avoid a crisis.
A crisis.
In 5 years' time.
What would be
when
the crisis?
When suddenly the Supreme Court, reinvigorated by a couple, two, three people of the Thomas Scalia persuasion, go on a rampage. They have shown no inclination, as the Bush against Gore decision suggests, to exercise restraint. They'll go on a rampage, suddenly, by striking down a host of environmental laws, they've already struck down a provision of the Violence Against Women Act. If they go on a rampage, then, of course, we will have a rerun of 1937. Or, as Randy correctly put it, if 1937 is just a sort of a phrase, but a period of self-conscious mobilization by the majority of this country to get these fellows in line. We don't need this. These constitutional crises induced by the Supreme Court are unfortunate, and the fact of the matter is that unlike Brown against Board of Education, which, of course, generated a constitutional crisis, that was 9-0. Unlike Roe against Wade, that, if you recall, is 7-2.
Let's get a response from Randy Barnett. What's your response to this, this idea that are we going to see these laws struck down, environmental laws, laws about public safety and so on?
As I already said, there's no indication in the current opinions that have created such a furor by some on the left that's what's in the cards. It might be in the cards, but as I say, there's nothing in the opinions that suggests that they're doing more than simply saying that this far and no farther. I think Bruce raises an interesting point when he talks about extremists on the court. I mean, one might say that one person's extremist is another person's freedom fighter. If Orrin Hatch is considered an extremist, then that suggests how politicized the appointments process is now becoming. It's basically getting to the and this really isn't what the topic of your show is on, which is the appointments process. It isn't the appointments process, but it's getting to the point where if you're a conservative Republican, which I should tell you that I am not, if you're a conservative Republican, you're disqualified as an extremist to be on the Supreme Court. If we get to that point, it's not going to be a pretty sight.
Mm-hmm. Let's bring in Congressman Barney Frank. Barney, welcome.
Thank you.
These debates, Congressman Frank, are really debating whether Congress can impose standards. Aren't they? Have we really? I thought we had settled all that question, that Congress does have the power to legislate in broad matters of interest.
I haven't heard much of the earlier part of the show being here in Washington, but it's very clear that we have a great radical change in what everybody had thought was the case with this five-member majority reasserting a concept of state sovereignty, which I can tell you, I was in Congress during many of these debates on the American Disabilities Act, for example, which they've gone after and some others, and the constitutional theory that the five-member majority is putting forward had no advocates within Congress. It was generally considered to be fairly settled that the federal government had a right to adopt uniform anti-discrimination policies. You know, George Bush, the president's father, signed the Anti-Discrimination Act, the American Disabilities Act. He was very proud of that. I have been appalled by this on several grounds. First of all, I disagree with the substantive result, and it is impossible for me to put aside the suggestion that the five-member majority, really none of them would have voted for these anti-discrimination laws, whether it's age or disability or other factors, and that's got some influence over them. But the one thing is very clear: to call this either judicial restraint or respect for precedent is just nonsensical. I mean, there has not been, I think, a sharper example of judicial activism breaking with what had considered to be the law and having enormous impact on the federal government than what the 5-member conservative majority has done. Now, that's perfectly okay. I don't object to them being judicial activists. I object to people pretending that they're not when they are.
Mm-hmm.
And there clearly has, and in fact, in one situation, even with regard to kind of the original meaning and the literal construction, there's one debate where Justice Scalia chides one of the more liberal 4 justices because he's interpreting language that says no citizen of one state shall sue another state. And the 5 members have taken that to mean that you can't even sue your own state, even for basic violations of your rights. And when one of the 4 minority justices said, well, wait a minute, it doesn't say you can't sue your own state. It says you can only sue another state. Scalia says that's an overly literalistic reading of the Constitution.
Mm, mm, mm. Yes, and I have, I've got some from a opinion of Justice Thomas. He writes, we the people, when the framers wrote we the people, they meant not we the people of a unified nation, but we the people of each state. This is sort of taking us back to popular sovereignty in the 19th century, isn't it?
It's a very fundamentally different conception of the way we work than we had before. Now, we can argue one way or the other. I would note that I think the 4 members have a better side of the argument. And when Scalia is objecting because we are literally reading the words, particularly given his general position of literalism, I think there's a great inconsistency there. But it is certainly the case that this is a great degree of activism and a great degree of breaking with the past. And also, by the way, activism in the sense that I think Justice Scalia and Thomas have at least tied any other justices in recent years for congressional statutes that they've knocked down.
Mm.
I mean, this notion that it's the conservatives who defer to the popular vote in the electoral process, and it's the activist liberals who strike it, you still see some of that rhetoric from people on the right, but it's just nonsensical.
Mm. Randy Barnett, who elected Clarence Thomas? I mean, didn't we elect Congress to pass these laws?
Well, none of the Supreme Court are elected, and it's part of our democratic process to have an unelected Supreme Court that's confirmed by a popularly elected Senate, nominated by a popularly elected president, to decide matters of the Constitution, matters involving constitutional interpretation. That's the system we've had for a long time. To hear some, one would think that no Supreme Court should ever strike down any law, that is activism in and of itself. I, by the way, never use the term activism as an epithet, but it certainly isn't activism when – I don't think it's activism when the court struck down the congressional prohibition on burning flags. I think that even though that the popular will apparently, mm-hmm. according to Congress at least, was mm-hmm. to prohibit flag burning, the court properly struck that down as violating the First Amendment. The court has properly protected a woman's right to choose, even though popularly Democratic elected legislators would put
that right at
jeopardy.
If you're addressing that to me, I agree with that. I want to be very clear. I have never used activism as a negative mm-hmm. phrase, and Professor Barnett hasn't, but conservatives have tried to get away with claiming that it was the liberals who were the activists. I don't think it's a useful concept.
But I was
glad that they voted to strike down the flag burning. I voted against the constitutional amendment to overturn that. But what I am saying is that it's the conservatives, if you read their literature or listen to their arguments, they pretend to be opposed to this when they are, in fact, have been very vigorous in striking down laws. I don't think that's wrong. I think what's wrong is the hypocrisy of pretending that you don't do that when you do.
Well, first of all, some of my best friends are conservatives, and I read all that they say, and I don't believe that most of them are being hypocritical the way they use the term activism. But look, the charge of hypocrisy just doesn't take you very far.
Well,
So what if they're being hypocritical? The question really is whether they're being right or not.
No, but this is what's important. I'm astonished that you would say that hypocrisy in political debate is irrelevant. I think it's very relevant for this reason. When people are being hypocritical, it's an indication that they don't want to use their real arguments. And that, I think, is quite relevant. And when you tell me that they use activism in a different way, I read these things and they – by activism, and I've seen this rhetoric. I've heard it from my conservative colleagues. They're talking about unelected judges striking down the popular will.
Right.
I don't object to that. I just object to people pretending, as I said, that there's something only the other side does when they do a lot of it.
Let's take a call from Colby. Hello.
Hi.
Hi. You've got a question about the Ninth and Tenth Amendment.
Yeah.
Well, give it to us.
Well, for one thing, the first thing I wanted to mention, though, was we used to say the United States are, as a plural, we used to say the United States are going to war. Mm-hmm. And now we say the United States is going to war. And it shows a change in thinking about the power of a state. But in the beginning, in the Constitution now, it says that in the Ninth and Tenth Amendment, that all rights not given in the Constitution specifically are retained by the states and the people. Mm-hmm. And that's I was told by a law professor that that's a dead letter. But who repealed the Ninth and Tenth Amendment to call it a dead letter?
Bruce Ackerman, who repealed the Ninth and Tenth Amendment?
Well, I'm glad you called me across these 3,000 miles.
Sorry, Bruce.
No, don't be silly. One thing to keep in mind is that the founders, the founding period was 200 years ago. The founders didn't even think it was possible in 1787 to define American citizenship. It was only after the Civil War that for the first time it became decisively clear that what Corey was referring to were views that were broadly held in the first 75 years of American history and generated the Civil War.
Generated the Civil War.
Absolutely. And and at the end of the Civil War, the Reconstruction Republicans expressed it. They didn't write for the first time. They expressed a new sense of nationhood this country and said that anybody born in the United States was a citizen of the United States and the state in which he resided, which was news to the founders. And then...
Right.
In the 20th century, we've had these profoundly nationalizing events, the First World War, the Great Depression,
sure.
The Second World War, and it's and when the Supreme Court tried to hold on to a deeply anachronistic conception that we first lived in the states and second in the nation, they were. Turn back, as you were pointing out, in the 1940s. Now, then we had another nationalizing, profoundly nationalizing movement in the 1960s, where for the first time, blacks actually could vote in this country, redeeming the promises of we the people of the nation against the states. And so the fundamental question for me is, under what conditions... You know, history changes, ideas move. Mm-hmm. Under what conditions does the Supreme Court have the authority under the Constitution to attempt a constitutional revolution against these
Congress.
Generations of nationalizing movements? And my answer is, at the very least, when it's squarely and explicitly endorsed by the American people today, and that hasn't happened.
Hang on for the break. Congressman Barney Frank, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
We hope you come back again. We're talking about the new federalism this hour at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the propriety of essentially having a constitutional revolution and returning powers Congress now has to the states. That may have been on the ballot in the 2000 election, to judge by some opinions of current Supreme Court justices and by some of the work of judges now sitting in the federal courts and who are possible nominees to the Supreme Court. We're talking with Randy Barnett. He's a professor of law at the Boston University. Bruce Ackerman is a professor of law at Yale. And our news analyst, Juliet Kayyem of the Kennedy School. Juliet, before the break, Bruce Ackerman was outlining the nationalizing events that have sort of made the doctrine of federalism seem archaic and something that is that is yesterday, and that the effort of the court to restore that would be wrenching development for American society.
Well, I do think, though, that the at least the triumvirate, and sometimes the five justices that we always talk about, but at least Scalia, Thomas, and Rehnquist, have been and are sometimes quite freely deferential to the political process. You can envision, you know, legislation having to do with law enforcement, sentencing, and certainly in the area of death penalty and habeas, they are exceptionally deferential. So in that sense, I think Congressman Frank is right that it's hard to have this discussion outside the substantive feelings that we have about the death penalty and about abortion rights and about what kind of country you want and what sort of protections. But where I think the federalism debate becomes confusing is it's, you know, the Ninth Amendment talks about the people and the Tenth Amendment talks about the states. And sometimes it's not entirely clear, you know, where we should stand. And I'll just give you one example. The Prince case, one of the cases that's often cited in all this, this was the case that struck down the Brady Bill with gun legislation. Who was one of the parties that was against striking it down? The court ultimately struck down the Brady Bill. It was actually the Conference of Mayors, maybe representing the people, the Conference of Mayors saying, we need this congressional legislation to help us representing the people because we need help with gun protection in our jurisdictions, in our localities, whatever. So in some ways, the court and at least Congress may be, you know, by helping localities and cities, helping the people more. So it's hard to say, you know, to construe the Ninth Amendment and the Tenth Amendment sometimes consistently.
Well, you, Randy Barnett, are an expert on the Ninth and the Tenth Amendment.
And he is carrying a Constitution.
Corey called us a moment ago and said the Ninth and the Tenth Amendment mean what they say. And what do they say?
Well, the Ninth Amendment says that the enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. That is an art. It's an injunction that says you shouldn't interpret the Constitution, the constitutional rights narrowly. That just because certain liberties are mentioned, that doesn't mean other liberties should not be protected. Mm-hmm. Now, judicial conservatives on the left and on the right, and there are judicial conservatives on both sides, are made very uncomfortable by the Ninth Amendment because it seems to authorize the protection of rights that are not specifically enumerated. In mm-hmm. other words, unenumerated rights. Justice Thomas, by the way, has been one of the justices that's been more favorable. Inclined to protecting unenumerated rights. He voted mm-hmm. with the majority mm-hmm. in U.S. v. Troxell, protecting a woman's right to raise her children contrary to the dictates of the grandparents, mm-hmm. and actually argued that such rights should receive strict scrutiny. Justice Scalia, on the other hand, is very, very skeptical about unenumerated rights. Mm-hmm. Now, the Tenth Amendment isn't about rights or liberties. The Tenth Amendment is about delegation or allocation of powers between the states and the federal government and between the people.
And that's the one that's at stake in the new federalism.
Right. That's at least the one that's called that the court has talked about. Yes, you're right.
In other words, they want to say to congressional legislation, no, this runs afoul of the Tenth Amendment.
Right.
These powers should be with the states.
Right. Now, here's what the Tenth Amendment says.
Yeah.
The powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution nor prohibited by it to the states are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. The Tenth Amendment actually doesn't say mm-hmm. whether a power resides in the states or whether it resides in the people. All it says is that mm-hmm. Congress should exercise only the powers that it has been delegated under the Constitution. So it's a power-limiting provision. Mm-hmm. And it simply echoes the first line of the Constitution I read to you at the beginning of the show, that mm-hmm. the Congress mm-hmm. only has the legislative powers herein
mm-hmm.
granted.
Mm-hmm.
So there's two things happening that the Supreme Court is doing, and we have to keep them separate. So the first one is they're trying to interpret the Commerce Clause more realistically to establish that, in fact, it is not an unlimited grant of power to the federal government.
And the Commerce Clause is?
Is the clause that has been used to justify most federal law, mm-hmm. which basically gives Congress the power to regulate commerce among the several states with Indian tribes and with foreign nations. It was a commerce-regulating provision, and it was never thought to be, and textually it's unsupportable to assert that it's an unlimited grant mm-hmm. of power to Congress. Mm-hmm. The Supreme Court, one thing of what the Supreme Court is doing is trying to figure out mm-hmm. if there are any limits there, where are they? The mm-hmm. other thing the Supreme Court is trying to do, which is in these federalism, these 11th Amendment cases, is given an extremely broad reading of congressional powers,
mm-hmm.
Is there any way of protecting the functionality of states from this broad reach? Mm-hmm. And that's what they purport to be doing under the 11th Amendment, although mm-hmm. Even they admit mm-hmm. that this is not a literal reading of the 11th Amendment, as Barney Frank correctly pointed out.
I ask our listeners, do you agree with Clarence Thomas when he says when the framers wrote "we the people," they meant not "we the people of a unified nation," but "we the people of each state"? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Brian is on the line. Hello.
Hi. Hey. I think that sometimes this, both the Ninth Amendment question, to the extent that it is a surrogate for strong individual rights, and the Tenth Amendment question, kind of get confused. That the court perhaps contributes to this, in that they are trying to maintain that there are certain things that should be done by the federal government and certain things that should be done by the state government. And while that is part of the enumerated powers argument, I think that the separation between the federal and state government that's being enforced is really for the protection of individual rights, and that I would like to, personally, I would favor a Tenth Amendment jurisprudence that defers to the level of government that is protecting individual rights. And that was really the purpose of the federal-state separation to begin with.
Yes. And does that mean you would favor a more national emphasis than state emphasis?
Well, no. The point is, if the federal government is stepping in to protect individual rights from the state, mm-hmm. then one would tend to defer. And again, that would be rights, not privileges. Mm-hmm. But one would tend to defer to the federal government because it's protecting individual rights. If the state is protecting an individual right, then one would defer to the state. So, for instance, in the Prince case, I mean, yep. let's argue, mm-hmm. although we can argue the meaning of the Second Amendment, realistically...
This was the gun control case.
Right, the gun control case. The right to carry a firearm is an enumerated right. And so I would argue that in essence, the case that says one should defer effectively to state law in that case, or mm-hmm. the local law, mm-hmm. says to the mayors that, look, you can't deprive people of a constitutional right like carrying
right.
a gun simply because it's convenient to
yep.
use a federal law to do so.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Bruce Ackerman, is that a Solomonic separation that we just heard effected?
Well, not at all. These are perfectly plausible arguments for Congress to consider. But it's quite a different thing to say that a Supreme Court or five members of the Supreme Court can simply revolutionize 60 years of law that was based on solid and systematic majority support, election after election. The federalism values are expressed in an ongoing manner in congressional debates. It's especially painful, as Randy was suggesting, at the present point at least, that the Supreme Court has no compelling theory. The idea that, well, before we took power mm-hmm. in 1995, well, a lot of things have happened. I don't really think that at least three of these justices would uphold the Civil Rights Acts of 1964 and 68.
Under this new federalist idea.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
The commerce, you know, and things mm-hmm. of this kind
right.
will lead to a much narrower, mm-hmm. if they were serious about it. But it's not, thus far no further, you see. Everything before we arose. Came onto the scene mm-hmm. and began to use this extraordinary capacity that we have mm-hmm. Is okay, but we're going to sort of nibble around the edges. Well, this is part, I must say, of a stealth strategy. If mm-hmm.
But it's hardly revolutionary, Bruce.
It isn't right now. That's right. That's why I divert.
It's a shadow no bigger than a man's hand
of tomorrow, rather
yeah.
than yesterday.
Right. We're talking about possibilities here.
Absolutely.
And there was an article by Jeffrey Rosen in the New York Times Magazine last year that went through some of the most outstanding people sitting on federal benches now who are comers in the conservative movement, and these people fit this grid of, you know, the new federalism to a T. And
absolutely.
And they were saying, look, this isn't about strict construction. This is about whether the states have the power or Congress has the power. Brian, thank you for your call. Peter is on the line.
Hi. The basic thrust that I have is that society is much more complex than when the Constitution was framed. I have a question and an argument. Don't answer the question. Just listen.
Okay.
The question is, were there corporations at the time of the drafting of the Constitution? My argument runs like this. I believe that the right to bear arms was guaranteed so that people could make revolution against the government. I believe that strict constructionism should say that I should be able to have any weapon that I can afford that the Army has, up to and including nuclear. Now, the framers never envisioned citizens owning a nuclear weapon.
No, they didn't.
That's a little complex.
Yeah.
So the Supreme Court has said you can't own a nuclear weapon. Heck, you can't even have a machine gun.
Yeah.
I agree with that.
Yeah.
But when faced with rapid transit between states, mm-hmm. the power of corporations, mm-hmm. I think just as the Supreme Court stomped on the will not infringe on the right of citizens to carry arms, they need to absolutely be just as activists and stomp on some of the ideas of states' rights.
Mm-hmm.
You know that North Carolina is not going to be able to fight, or Louisiana can't fight corporations now.
Sure.
That's why the only vinyl made in the U.S. is made there. They need the money.
Right.
So, your
right.
turn.
Right. How about that, Randy Barnett? I mean, after the Civil War, this doctrine basically of substantive due process was a way of applying the 14th Amendment, which was the Freedom Amendment after the Civil War, according equal protection of the laws to former slaves. It was corporations who invoked that and who said, you can't interfere in our business, states, because we have substantive due process. We have equal protection of the laws. And isn't this one of the dangers of this new federalism, that the attempt to deal with corporate power, national power, will be lost to a national government? And if we have just states dealing with it, they're overwhelmed.
Well, Congress has the power to regulate commerce amongst the states. The Congress has the power. He was granted the power in the Constitution to regulate interstate commerce. And the Supreme Court has interpreted that extraordinarily broadly. The Rehnquist Court has interpreted that much more broadly than the original meaning. The original meaning of commerce was trade or exchange. It did not extend to all economic activities. It did not extend to agriculture. It did not extend to manufacturing. The Rehnquist Court has basically equated commerce with economic activity.
Mm-hmm.
That's much broader than the original meaning. Now, if they're to be faulted, they're to be faulted for not taking as narrow an original meaning as the Constitution actually says. What they have done in attempting to draw this line is to basically say, look, there's a fundamental principle of this Constitution, mm-hmm. which is the Congress does not have unlimited powers.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to figure out what are the lines.
Mm-hmm.
And they've acted, I have to say, not in a revolutionary fashion, and I wish they would. But they're acting in a judicious fashion and basically saying, how can we basically circumscribe, given today's economy, given mm-hmm. the interconnections?
Mm-hmm.
And they've done this by making the distinction between economic and non-economic activity.
Mm-hmm. Do you see this, Bruce Ackerman, this distinction at work?
Professor Barnett to say that if he were a justice of the Supreme Court, your question would be very anxiety-provoking for the rest of Americans. That is to say, the thing that is surprising for him is how much the Rehnquist Court says that it has adapted to the realities of 20th century economic life and 20th century nationhood, and that if they're to be criticized, of course, they should cut back yet more. And my anxiety, of course, is that we're right in the middle of a creeping revolution. I very much reject the thought that what has gone on is not revolutionary. These five justices did in 1995, as part of the Gingrich Revolution, first assert the power for the after 60 years of putting an unprincipled check on Congress's allocation of power between state and nation. In the year 2000, they intervened to determine the identity of the president of the United
Bruce,
States.
Bruce, you're putting your finger on
this is not little stuff we're talking about.
We take your point. Thank you very much, Bruce.
Sure.
Bruce Ackerman is the Sterling Professor of Law and Political Science at Yale Law School. Randy Barnett, thank you. Randy Barnett is the Austin B. Fletcher Professor of Law at Boston University School of Law. Juliet Kayyem, thank you very much. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners.